For more than a decade, Ethan Nadelman has been writing about the costs and consequences of drug prohibition in the United States. Nadelman is a former professor of politics and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. He's currently the director of the Lindesmith Center, a drug policy research institute in New York City. In his essay in the latest edition of National Review, Nadelman argues that our drug control policies cause more harm than the drugs themselves. He feels the time has come to abandon the concept of a drug-free society and to institute some measure of legal availability and regulation. When I spoke with Ethan Nadelman, I asked him to support his claim that the war on drugs has been lost.
Well, I think it's failed by its own criteria. If this war has succeeded, drug abuse would be a minor problem in America. If this war had succeeded, we would probably not be incarcerating hundreds of thousands of Americans and arresting a million a year for drug law violations. If this war had succeeded, we would not have a dreadful drug-related AIDS problem and all the other drug-related problems we have. So by its chosen criteria, the war on drugs has failed. Now, Barbara, I think it's important, though, to realize that we're not just talking about a war on drugs. We're talking about a drug prohibition system, very much like alcohol prohibition was 60 years ago, except more severe in many respects. I mean, it's not just that we should shift more resources to our treatment and prevention instead of waging a criminal justice fight in this area, which is something we should do. It's a good half step. It's that prohibition itself, treating drugs as a prohibition problem, using prohibition laws, is responsible for most of what Americans commonly identify as part and parcel of the drug problem. And in this respect, it's just like alcohol prohibition. I mean, we instituted alcohol prohibition in 1919 because we thought we could get rid of alcohol drinking and alcohol problems. And in fact, prohibition was moderately successful, at least in its initial years, in reducing alcohol consumption and alcohol-related ills. But by the end of alcohol prohibition, alcohol use had gone way up. And at the same time, what had emerged was Al Capone and organized crime and rising levels of violence and corruption, overflowing prisons and courthouses and jail cells, tens of millions of Americans breaking the law, an atmosphere of lawlessness, as well as tens of thousands of Americans dying from bad bootleg liquor. Liquor that was more dangerous because it was illegal. Now, it's the same thing today. Drug prohibition may discourage some people from becoming drug users. Drug prohibition may reduce drug abuse some small degree. But look at what it generates. I mean, drug-related, or I should say prohibition-related crime and violence. So many of the homicides in our inner cities are prohibition-related. Not drug-related so much, but prohibition-related.
Isn't that the fear, though, that many voice about legalization, that once you ease up, there's no going back, that the issue is to legalize or not to legalize?
That is the fear that people express, but it's not all that well based. I mean, you know, the United States has a long history with what are called sunset laws, where you basically say that you will do a new policy for 2 years or 3 years, and then it will be evaluated. And if it's not proving satisfactory, you go back on it, you repeal it. So one can, in fact, well, like, look what Switzerland's doing right now. They didn't legalize drugs 2 years ago. They started a national experiment to prescribe heroin to hardcore drug addicts in Zurich and Bern and a number of other cities. And they wanted to see, they took a group of a few hundred serious drug addicts, people who had tried to quit both with methadone in therapeutic communities and had persistently failed. Half of them probably have HIV or AIDS. And they said, the authorities said, we know that heroin doesn't destroy the human body. We know from the scientific and historical evidence that people can lead a semi-normal life as a heroin addict if they have access to clean, legal, pharmaceutical-grade heroin. It's not like cocaine or alcohol or even cigarettes where it destroys your body organs. So they started a program to give drug addicts, or to sell it to them actually for about $10, $15 a day, heroin, clean, legal heroin in clinics. Now, they've been doing this now for 2 years, and the program has been sufficiently successful that they've expanded it to almost 1,000 slots in 13 cities around the country. When they define success, what they mean is that the health of the addicts has improved dramatically. It appears that they're less involved with crime. Their use of illicit drugs has declined. There have been no overdose deaths. There has been almost no problem of heroin being diverted to the streets. That by and large, the overall situation involving heroin addicts and their impact on the community has improved. Now, one of the things, I mean, you know, to talk about a heroin prescription program is not talking about legalization, and it's also not talking about something you can never go back on. It's talking about taking a scientific, common sense, humane approach to a serious problem and seeing pragmatically what works.
I think that the standards, at least of the president administration, are to work towards a drug-free society, and that one administration official phrased the idea of giving up the war on drugs is throwing in the towel, and that's the message you're sending to the nation, to our nation's youth.
I know. I mean, it's a little ludicrous in a way. I mean, in 1988, Congress passed the a resolution where they declared that America would be a drug-free society by 1995. Now, that's an absurd, ludicrous notion. The bottom line is that drugs are here to stay. Drugs have always been here. Drugs are always going to be here. Virtually every civilized society in human history has had powerful psychoactive drugs in its midst. The ones that have been most successful in dealing with drugs have not been those that sought to eradicate them through totalitarian means or what have you. It's been those societies that figured out how to learn to live with drugs in such a way that they cause the least possible harm. Can we, for example, by promoting designated driving norms, reduce fatalities on the roads? By using seatbelts and encouraging seatbelts, can we reduce fatalities? By cracking down on drunken driving? By teaching kids the difference between responsible alcohol use and irresponsible alcohol use? These are all ways of reducing the harms associated with alcohol. And I think the same sort of approach is needed with illicit drugs.
So how would this work if you, say, legalized cocaine? What would a federal drugstore look like?
Well, at the end of alcohol prohibition, people said, what should come after alcohol prohibition? And what we decided on was a high measure of local option, that states and local communities should be able to control this. I think the same is true when we talk about legalizing marijuana, cocaine, heroin, Valium, I mean, any other drug that you want to talk about. Now, let me just say, Barbara, one of the minimum that I think we would need nationally, however, is that American adults, it should be legal for an adult to possess and consume a small amount of any drug for personal use, so long as they do not engage in a dangerous behavior like getting behind the wheel of a car. I mean, I think that crucial ingredient, that the legalization of personal possession is a central ingredient of any alternative drug control policy. The interesting questions emerge when you decide, how do we make drugs legally available? That's where the tough issues are, and that's where much of the debate is when people start to think about a post-prohibition America.
Ethan Nadelman is the director of the Linda Smith Center, a drug policy research institute in New York City. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue with the second part of our discussion with Ethan Nadelman, the director of the Linda Smith Center, a drug policy research institute in New York City. When we left off, we touched on how drugs would be distributed if they were decriminalized. How do you explain how the free market economy would work? I mean, now that there is a whole criminal infrastructure, I mean, where would our federal drug state stores or whatever get their cocaine if we started growing it here, developing our own domestic market, certainly?
Well, I don't really think, I mean, that's not a tough issue, really. I mean, right now, coca and cocaine is produced in both legally and illegally throughout South America. Now, I think when you talk about cocaine, it's important to realize that, first of all, we wouldn't just legalize cocaine and nothing else. I mean, this would be in the context of making available a variety of drugs, stimulants, depressants, what have you, under fairly strictly regulated conditions, but some of those might be safer than cocaine. And in fact, given a wider array of options, consumers might opt for something other than cocaine. Also understand that cocaine, you know, one just can't talk about cocaine as a single drug. I mean, there is a world of difference between the cocaine that is consumed in Bolivia and Peru when the Indians chew the coca leaf and get the cocaine that comes from the leaf, as opposed to yuppies snorting a line of cocaine, as opposed to yuppies freebasing, as opposed to poor inner city people smoking crack. I mean, it's the same drug, cocaine, but the consequences of that use are radically different, depending both upon the nature of the drug, the way it's consumed, and who's consuming it. So when we talk about legalization of cocaine, I think where one would start would be with a low-potency cocaines. I mean, Bolivia and Peru now would like to be able to export low-potency cocaine products, coca tonics, coca teas, coca medicines, coca toothpaste, these sorts of things, which have almost no danger of addiction associated with them. They're probably more innocuous than caffeinated beverages are. There's no reason not to allow Bolivia and Peru to do that, except for our sort of moral craze against cocaine. So I would make available, under different types of legal regulatory models, low-potency cocaine. I don't think it's necessary for the government to stand out there and start making legally available crack cocaine. No more, for example, than it was necessary at the end of alcohol prohibition for the government to start selling 180-proof moonshine. I mean, the bottom line was people bought moonshine because that's what they could get during prohibition. But most wanted beer or beer and wine. It's the same thing today. Crack is, in very many respects, the moonshine of drug prohibition. It's not clear that we would have a major crack market in America if it were legal. And in fact, most Americans tend to prefer those drugs which are relatively less dangerous. So, I mean, we can work this out. Believe me, any approach is better than the current one, where we have tens of billions of dollars being made by criminals marketing cocaine in its most lethal forms today.
Are you saying that increased exposure to drugs doesn't matter, doesn't result in more addicts?
Well, it depends what you mean by increased exposure. Let's not forget that we already live in a world in which we are all incredibly exposed to drugs. We live in a world in which alcoholic beverages are widely available, and any kid who wants to get it can get it, in which cigarettes are widely available, a world in which you can buy drugs over the counter, anti-congestants, what have you, and get high as a kite if you want to, where you can get drugs from a doctor. I mean, anybody more or less in the middle class who wants Prozac or Valium can more or less get those drugs if they know the right doctor. So we can get that. We can get alcohol, tobacco, over-the-counter, under-the-counter, behind-the-counter drugs. And then for those people who are simply too poor or too young, well, they go and sniff gasoline or sniff glue, or they use something else. I mean, anybody who thinks that somehow if you got rid of cocaine tomorrow that we would still have a drug problem should look in the poorest parts of the world where there are millions of kids sniffing glue, sniffing petrol, and there's nothing the law enforcement establishment can do about that. So don't think that legalization means all of a sudden we live in a drug-infested Sodom and Gomorrah world. In fact, we already live in a world where drugs are everywhere. We already live in a world where most of us have learned how to live with drugs. Making drugs legally available will modestly increase the availability of drugs. It'll dramatically decrease the connection between those drugs and crime.
What public health policy initiatives should then accompany a change in our drug policy?
Well, I mean, I'm a strong supporter of very powerful harm reduction-oriented public health approaches to substance abuse. I mean, I think that we have to accept the fact that there's a few million people in this country who are hardcore drug users, and we want to reduce the death, disease, and crime that they're involved in. Now, that means making needles readily available. It means making methadone as available as possible to drug addicts. I mean, people don't realize methadone is to street heroin more or less what nicotine chewing gum or nicotine patch is to cigarettes. It can make you addicted or dependent. That's hard to quit, but it causes virtually no harm to the human body. What it's designed to do is to reduce the negative consequences of street heroin or tobacco, the crime or the poisonings or the cancer. We should make methadone much more available instead of doing what we do now, which is to, it's now this most strictly regulated drug in the entire pharmacopoeia. I mean, people can't go to a doctor and get methadone. They have to go to some clinic, which may be dozens or hundreds of miles from their home. So I'd make methadone more widely available. I would experiment with heroin prescription, like they're doing in Switzerland now, and like the Dutch and the Australians are about to start. I would certainly make both heroin and marijuana available for medical purposes. I mean, I think it's a national scandal that people who are sick cannot get marijuana to deal with glaucoma, to deal with the nausea that attends chemotherapy, to deal with some of the symptoms of the AIDS wasting syndrome. I mean, that's purely immoral to deprive sick people of medication. I would go further. I would institute some measure of marijuana legal availability, allowing states and localities to control it. But I'd also put forward a very serious drug education campaign. I mean, I would go far beyond our current just say no approach.
The first anti-opium laws in the 19th century were directed at Chinese immigrants in California who ran opium dens. Does the history of our anti-drug legislation follow this pattern of singling out minorities?
Very much so. The first anti-opium laws in America were directed at Chinese immigrants in California and Nevada and associated with anti-Chinese sentiment. The first anti-cocaine laws in America were in the southern states in the first decade of the century, and they were directed at blacks. It was feared that Negroes would forget themselves and go out and rape white women and would be immune to gunshot from police officers if they were crazed on cocaine. The first anti-marijuana laws in this country were in the 1920s in the Midwest and were directed at Mexican immigrants. So there's a very powerful connection between the origins of our drug laws and racism. And I think the same continues to hold true today. I mean, why is it? We take an activity like selling cocaine Now, that's an activity that was legal 100 years ago. Now we incarcerate people for up to life for engaging in that activity. And we now have, I mean, there's 1.5 million Americans behind bars today. About one quarter of them, about 350,000, are there for violating a drug law. And they're there oftentimes for very, very long periods of time because of mandatory minimum sentences. Why are we willing to do that? My own impression is that if we were incarcerating hundreds of thousands of middle-class white Americans, we would not be so ready to throw people away and throw away the key. I do think it is because this is a business in which inner city blacks and Hispanics have been disproportionately represented that the American public is much more willing to toss these people away and just forget about them. So I do think that racism in a subtle way, much more subtle than it was before, but nonetheless in a subtle way, does continue to shape American drug policy.
Are you in favor of a large federal investment and federally run program for rehabilitation of drug addicts?
I believe that the government should include funds for drug treatment as part of its overall health care. There's right now most drug treatment for poor people, I think, is paid through Medicare. There are specialized drug treatment programs, but a lot of it comes through their major healthcare system. I think, in fact, I know that the dramatic cuts in healthcare expenditures that are being either enacted or proposed are going to devastate access to drug treatment for poor people in America, and that the results are going to be more disease, more death, and more crime because people will be forced to turn to the streets to get drugs that they can't get from doctors and hospitals. But quite frankly, if we could cut the law enforcement budget on drugs by 80% and just give half of that to drug treatment, we would have remarkable, remarkable improvement in our drug situation in America.
How then would you rate the importance in the larger context of rehabilitation? Is it 50%? Is it as important as any other aspect of the program? Is it the most important aspect of a change in our drug policy?
Now, if I was going to expand drug treatment in this country, I would focus on the voluntary aspects of drug treatment, the needle exchange programs, the methadone clinics, where people go because they want to go there, where people go to seek help. The whole push in America today is in favor of coercive drug treatment. It's that we only want to give people services if we're coercing them, if we're punishing them. Well, I think that's morally abhorrent, and I don't think it's very effective. I think we should do as much as we can to make treatment services available, accessible, and attractive to people who have problems with drugs. And that's what would work best for American society at large as well.
Ethan Nadelman, I want to thank you very much for talking on Fresh Air today.
Hey, Barbara, thank you very much.
Ethan Nadelman is the director of the Linda Smith Center, a drug policy research institute in New York City. This is Fresh Air.